With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Just talk to this girl. Used to live, yeah, on my street. Whoa. After all these years, you're here. And you remember me. Whoa. She said her old boyfriend packed up and headed back east, but she always knew someday he would go. She just got a new job and she doubts it will last. So let's take a drink and never think it is to the past. She said it's so funny how life burns out so fast. It's just another wasted day.
So we're good to go because we level checked last time.
Perfect.
And we're hitting the ground running. So I'm here on the tour bus with Chris from Less Than Jake.
Yes.
This is a funny full circle moment. The very first episode that I recorded for this podcast, it didn't go out first, but the first one that I did was 4 years ago on the Fireball Tour with Roger, sat in these exact seats. Nice. And now we've got you on the show. It's taken me almost 3 years.
It's come full circle.
But here we are. And you won't see this because obviously this is audio, but myself and Chris are in full costume. So you'll just have to imagine what that is and let your imagination run wild. And that leads us into the first talking point, which I wanted to get into, which is stage costumes. Now, this is the fourth tour, I think, that we've done together now. And I wasn't aware of your panache for the stage costume. Quite like myself, you're a man that likes to dress up for the occasion. You recently joined Instagram. You're kind of a bit late to the game, but since joining, smashing it with the content, like the kids like to call it, and every day you do an old school picture from the vault, and you, like myself as well, you do these nice long posts that kind of set the scene, tell the story. I wanted to ask you first of all, Chris, about some of the proudest costumes and creations and characters from the old school touring days of Less Than Jake, well, and then funny stories that came with them, either fan interactions or interactions with other bands who maybe didn't know who you were.
Yeah, it was crazy because the costumes were bred out of boredom. It was before smartphones and all this stuff that occupy our hands these days and our minds. So it really started. I always liked to dress up. It wasn't all the time, but we were out on the road with a band called Skank and Pickle.
I know them. Yeah, Cut Flipper.
Yeah, and Mike Park was in that band, and we loved those guys. And their trombone player Jerry used to do this bit in the band that he would pretend he was Hulk Hogan. He'd rip his shirt off. So long story short, he would go out to a thrift store and secondhand store and get a different shirt every day to rip off his back. And I would follow him around on tour to these thrift stores. I'm like, that's a funny wig. That's a funny pair of glasses. That's a really bad, gaudy gold necklace or watch. That's a horrible pair of pants. And I just started amassing these costumes.
And you actually had characters as well, didn't you? Like the costumes that I wear are pop culture figures that people know. You'd invent your own guys, and often they'd even have names and backstories. Like you'd go full method.
Yeah. No, it was ridiculous. It was, there was times when it was an all day thing. Like, oh, if I had this for this character, and I paid attention to detail. That was the big thing. I wasn't gonna half ass it. I wasn't gonna have the right pants, the right shirt, the right wig for the time period, but you look down and you got shoes that are current.
Exactly, because then the myth is completely unraveled and the character's broken.
Right. So, unlike yourself, these were unknown characters that I invented. A lot of them were just inspired by living in Florida. I would see these guys at my Little League games.
I mean, this is quite a Florida style getup I've got going on right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not really
the golf retirement.
Yeah, it's not really a Glasgow look.
No. And Florida's one of those places. You've got a real range of characters. It's where a lot of people go to retire, isn't it? But then you've also got the full on swamp.
Yeah,
for lack of a better word,
you got
redneck,
the local
right?
rednecks. Yeah. There's a lot to offer in Florida.
Yeah,
a lot to offer. So, yeah, the characters were just. A lot of them were what I would see on a daily basis growing up in Florida. And so I would take these on stage, and I just basically did it at first to kind of get a laugh from the band. You know, they'd be like, you know, what the hell are you doing? Are you dressed like a baseball player? You know, full, you know, makeup under the eyes, hats. God, there were so many costumes. And after a while, they started to morph the characters. So this pair of pants and that shirt with that wig, well, that was kind of the other guy, but it wasn't. So, that you know, the characters would, like, have this weird metamorphosis going on all the time.
And what happened in Spain, you posted this recently, there was a Warped Tour show in Pamplona, was it? And
yes.
There was, like, some sound problems. So basically you guys were, like, an hour late going on stage. And
yeah.
You filled the time creatively.
So, yeah, so Ignite was there. It was the European Warped Tour. Pennywise was there. A bunch of other bands. Ignite had just finished their set. We were scheduled to go on, and I was dressed in a pretty toned-down outfit at this point. I can't remember what it was, but it wasn't anything crazy. And we knew it was going to be a little while, and a little while turned into a half hour, 45 minutes. So I donned what I called my Richard Simmons, like, fitness guru outfit, like tight nut-hugging pink shorts, socks pulled up to the knees, really bad shoes. And I would purposely, like, get shoes three sizes too big, so it looked like clown shoes.
Yeah.
You know, it was all part of the thing. Terrible gold necklace, really bad rings and bracelets. And long story short, I basically went out in this bull ring and entertained the crowd. And at first, they loved it. They loved it. They were cheering for me. I got on stage. The PA had come back on. They were still working on other things. Got on stage and I did like an acapella version of You Shook Me All Night Long by AC/DC.
Amazing.
They were still kind of liking it, but I went on a little too long and now cups of piss are starting to come up at me. So I went off the stage and we get noticed that it's a go now. You guys are on. I get into an empty road case and our roadie, Mr. Skull at the time, push me out and I pop out with my guitar to this road case and everyone's just like,
The big reveal.
The big reveal wasn't the greatest reveal. So yeah, they were just born out of boredom. You know, that was the one day, and I didn't mention the story because I ran out of room in Instagram. That was the first time that Fletcher from Pennywise ever laughed at us. I was like, okay,
seal of approval, right?
I think we broke the, you know, broke the back of Fletcher. You know, he finally gave in.
How good's that story in South Africa or wherever it is with him and the elephant? That legendary story.
I don't know that. What did you hear about that story?
I heard that he broke into the elephant enclosure and was trying to feed the baby elephant a sip of his beer. And the mama elephant, obviously in protection, flicked him with her trunk. And obviously Fletcher's a big dude, sent him flying across. He smashed into the cage, apparently broke all his ribs, really wanted to go to hospital or cancel the show. But everyone was like, it's your own stupid fault. You're playing the gig. So he just had to play the show.
That's pretty much the story I heard. I didn't know it was in South Africa, though.
I think Dave has the video on his phone because he was there filming it. So is he coming to the show on Friday?
If he is, I'm going to ask him to see it.
Him and
yes.
I've never seen it. So if he does have it,
okay,
I need to see it too.
Fair enough. Yeah, we got the Fletcher seal of approval that day. And that was cool.
Who were some of the biggest Hellraisers that you toured with back in the 90s? Were there any bands that were notorious for their antics?
Oh,
obviously,
man.
Fletcher I know is. But
yeah, Fletcher was one of them. But Guttermouth.
He still is, Mark.
Yeah, Mark.
He did Slam Dunk last year, and he came out at midday. He necked an entire bottle of red wine and then just proceeded to get butt naked on stage. Nobody does that anymore. With smartphones, it's kind of not a smart move.
No, but Mark does
he
that.
He doesn't give a fuck.
Mark, no, yeah. So, and especially back in the 90s, those guys were out of control, every one of them. I won't mention what guy in the band, but we were backstage one time and he gets out this container. It almost looked like something like your grandma would put like buttons and stuff in for sewing.
Right.
He opens it up. There must have been 1,000 pills in there of all different variants, shapes, sizes, and it was just like,
colors.
Oh wow, these guys are here to have a party. Pie tasters were nuts.
Yeah,
pie tasters.
I've never seen them live. You know, do they still tour?
They still play. Yeah, they just played Gainesville not too long ago, but pie tasters were, oh man, out of control.
What about you guys? Did you have a rep?
Not really. You know, we mostly, when we first got a bus, like, we would always just kind of like hang out there.
Yeah.
Because it was, like, new to us. So we'd always have people on our bus and party. We didn't really go out too much in the early days of the bus. But, yeah, we only had a rep because we tried to keep up with Pie Tasters, Guttermouth. Frenzel Rom was another one.
The Aussie
Australia
band. Yeah.
Those guys, whew.
and in trying to keep up, you end up on the floor.
Yeah, but you know, but those three bands had a different kind of resolution about them than most people. You know, they would go all night, survive on minimal sleep, and then you'd turn up at the club midday, and they're already drinking again.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Mark was very much on that tip at Slam Dunk. As I said, midday every day because they were on first. He'd turn up, bottle of red for lunch or breakfast, probably for him.
Yeah.
Smash the show, get naked, pass out. On to the next town. It was amazing.
Yeah. Getting naked in the era of smartphones isn't necessarily the best
one, is it?
The best idea.
I mean, kind of the whole idea of being punk now. I mean, you know, you would have come up at that time when punk was still like, you know, it was a dangerous scene. And if you were going out with Mohawks and, you know, kind of being this kind of confrontational upstart, you'd get probably, you know, not only disapproving looks, but you'd probably get set upon by locals, right? Did you ever have your ass beat as a kid for being a punk?
Yeah, I mean, not really as a kid. It was more like when I got into college.
Right.
But, you know, I never had my ass beat necessarily, but definitely, you know, well, the band fought its way out of a few venues in the early days. So yeah, it was part of the territory. But there wasn't really any places to play where we were from either. So we were playing redneck bars in North Gainesville on a Tuesday night. And who's going to turn up there? The locals. And like, who are these kids with blue hair jumping around? So, you know, some nights didn't end as well as others.
What was the Gainesville scene like? Was Against Me popping around the same time as you guys? Were they slightly before?
They weren't. Against Me came
later.
Were
they a Gainesville band?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gainesville band, yeah. But they're a little cough, younger than us. So they, yeah, they came around 97, 98. So we started like 92. They weren't there from the beginning when we had started. But the scene was, you know, Gainesville's this little, you know, microcosm in Florida. It's this little own little thing, and it's a very liberal little college town with like 100,000 college kids in North Florida, and then you go out 5 miles either way and you're in like the sticks, you're in the middle of nowhere,
alligator country.
So there was a ton of places to play. I came from 3 hours south. That's where Vinny and I grew up, in a place called Port Charlotte.
Is it you two who started the band?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was 3 hours south, and it couldn't have been any different. It'd be like going from Scotland to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, right.
For real. It just was such a different... We didn't have any good record stores, no punk record stores. Everything was...
Just breaking for a beverage?
Yeah, we'd have to drive like 30 miles to get a good record store, drive an hour, hour and a half to get to a show.
Do you know what, though? I think there's something, maybe I'm just over-romanticizing it with nostalgia, but there's almost a magic in the quest. Like, now all music is just completely accessible at the touch of a button. That element of discovery and working for it has kind of gone, right? Like, when you're a kid, you save up, you know, X amount of money, and then you get this one record because that's all you can afford, and you play it out, and you know the words inside and out. I feel like that culture with streaming has kind of gone, right?
Well, it is gone, but I don't know if it could ever be replicated. You know, that's what younger people know now.
Yeah.
There's younger people, like my son's never going to know, or daughter's not going to know what a CD is.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to look like some relic that, you know, your grandparents used. So, you know, technology is what it is. It isn't the same. You know, we started, I like to call it, in the analog era.
Yeah.
Where we weren't recording anything. It was all to tape. All your mistakes were there. You know, getting out. I've always said I want to make a reality show where you send a band out now, 19-year-old kids. No smartphones, just maps.
Yeah.
You have to get from
pay
here
phones.
To there. Maps and payphones. Yeah.
I mean, again,
you wouldn't find a payphone, though, so
you wouldn't.
Be
they're
off the
all
bat.
Gone, aren't they? But there's all these stories that people used to just sneak into the promoter's office, make long distance calls to back home, you know, and they'd get out of town. And...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that happened a few times.
You guys did Warped Tour more than any other band. Is that right?
That is true.
So let's go in on some Warped Tour stories, because that is such, I've never done it, but I imagine it is such a unique and punishing. Also great, but hardcore grafting experience.
Well,
right?
I can give you the rundown. We did half the tour in 1997. Our then manager had contacted us in the spring, probably around March or April, and said, remember Warp Magazine out of California?
I was
No. I was saying, you wouldn't remember. And I'm like, yeah, I know Warp Magazine. It was a big like surf, skate, culture magazine in Southern California. They had written about the band. Yeah, well, they're partnering. They're doing this thing with Vans, and they're doing this tour. This guy, Kevin Lyman. All right. And it's a traveling festival, and it's these bands. It was like Lagwagon, Bad Religion, Suicidal Tendencies. It was like, sign us up. And we went out for 2 weeks that summer. Never had heard of it. It had been out for two summers, but this is pre-social media. you know, we were out touring in a van 9 months, 10 months out of the year. So we were closed off from, you know, a lot of things. Hadn't heard of the Warped Tour. Went out. Wow. So that was 97. We did half the tour, and that was East Coast. And then we got offered half the tour on the West Coast in 1998. Later that year, we went to New Zealand on New Year's Eve and played Warped Tour there, and then went to Australia, did the Warped Tour Australia.
So it went international pretty quick.
And then from there, we came into the European Warped Tour. Well, excuse me, all of the 99 Warped Tour in the whole U.S., then the European Warped Tour, where the Bullring incident was in 99. In 2000, we did four shows that Green Day dropped off, the last four in Texas. 2001, we did the whole tour. 2003, we did the whole U.S. tour. 2004, we did the 10th anniversary show in Boston. Did the whole tour in 2006, did the whole tour in 2009, the whole tour in 2011, the whole tour in 2014. Did another England Warped Tour somewhere in there, 13, 14. Did the Warped Tour cruise. That was in 2017. Did the whole thing in 2016, the whole thing in 2018, and we did the two shows this year that they did.
Wow.
In 2019. We're up to 441 Warped Tour shows.
How is your memory so good? I noticed this with all your Instagram posts. Like, you remember the date, the city, the whole... backstory.
Yeah, it's really useless information.
It only
impresses people once in a while, like right now, but it doesn't gain me anything monetarily. It's really useless knowledge. If I could use it for something else, trust me, I would.
Is that across the board, though? Are you one of those guys? Like, if you meet someone once, is it kind of instilled in your brain, the face?
Not always, but yeah, I've been pretty good. I was lucky as a kid. If I would always pay attention in classes. I didn't like to study and read. I liked to listen, and so...
Did you go to college? Have you got a degree?
No, I don't have a degree. I went to college for 2 years. So I had what was about the equivalent of what we call an associate's degree.
Okay.
But I never got the degree. I never finished.
Did it happen for you guys pretty early on in your life? Were you in a touring, you know, professional band?
You know,
age were you when, you know, you were getting signed and doing it for real?
I was 18 when I moved, 4 months shy of my 18th birthday when I moved to Gainesville in the summer of 91. And I had been corresponding with Vinny back home, writing these songs, and we hadn't had a name yet, but we did a demo, and he had sent me the demo, and it had Less Than Jake written on it. I was like, what the hell is that? He's like, well, you know how my mom, when we're practicing at the house, she always, like, bothers us and, you know, comes, knocks on the door and says, hey, the music's bothering the dog, Jake, who's the bulldog. He'd be howling. He didn't like the bass, so we'd always have to stop. So we were Less Than Jake. I'm like, that's really stupid. But we needed a name, and that's what we called it. And so
it's a great name.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it kind of weirdly suits. I mean, there's certain names that make no sense, but then they just exactly suit the sound, the package. Mm-hmm. I think you're one of those bands.
Yeah. So,
same thing with Real Big Fish. You know what I mean? That name makes no sense, but it's so perfect for them and what they do.
Yeah. Yeah. No. It was definitely meant to be. But at the time, it wasn't like we all rallied behind this name. It was just something to put on the demo tape that we had released.
So when you're first out on the road, are you feeling like this is going to be me? I'm in this for the long haul. I want to do this as a job. Were you instantly
enticed by the life? No, because it wasn't like that at all. So we did this demo that I was handing out at shows for free in like early 92. And then in June of that year, we got another bass player. And we always count July 14th of 92 is the inception of the band, because that's when we played our first show. We figured you're a legit band when you play your first show.
Yeah.
And that was with this other guy, Chris. He played bass. And he was with us till about October, November of 92. And things just weren't working out with him. And Vinny and I wanted to go on. We had another batch of songs written. And I had met Roger.
Was he in a band at that time? What was he doing?
He wasn't. He was had been in Gainesville for a little less than I had, because he started the 92 school year. He was a year behind me. And so I had been there a year, and I met him through my roommate. She had met him at a dorm party one night. I heard this guy play guitar. You're looking for someone to play guitar? And I'm like, no, we're looking for a bassist. And she's like, well, you know, he should come over and meet him. So she had him come over one night, and I had my guitar in my room and handed it to him, and he started. I'm like, this guy's great. And then I'm like, can you play bass? He goes, never tried. So he went out and he bought a $50 bass the next day and a little bass amp. And he had actually wired a car speaker to make a cabinet for the amp. And he became the bass player in January of 93. Played our first show with him in March. So we were doing all really like local shows in Florida. It wasn't anything outside of Florida. And we built up a pretty good following in 3 years. It wasn't until the summer of 95 that we went on our first U.S. tour.
Would you credit bands like Rancid, Offspring, Green Day, NoFX, and the success of them in 94, 95 as opening the gate for a lot of that generation that immediately followed on?
Well, I mean, yeah.
In terms of the way they popularized punk rock.
Of course. Yeah, and they were like, you know, kind of the big ones, but there was a ton of bands that laid the groundwork. And you had 80s bands like, you know, the Toasters and Fishbone, and they were out there slogging it out in clubs when I had no idea they were even out there touring. I hadn't heard of the Toasters until I got to college. Again, I was from this little insular town in Florida, you know, and when I got to Gainesville, it was like my eyes opened up, like, oh my God, so there's more to the world than what was down there. You know, it was very... I don't want to say so much closed. I wasn't closed-minded by nature. I was closed-minded by my surroundings.
Yeah, environmentally and closed off.
Yeah.
A big part of the Less Than Jake sound is obviously the trade-off between the vocals of yourself and Roger. Was that an immediate formula that you happened upon and went, this is pretty good, this marks us apart, something a bit different?
So that would start with him and I listening to, you know, our favorite bands or and just with two acoustic guitars. We'd sit across from each other. We lived in the same... apartment.
We'd live in a McCartney style.
Yeah, and we lived in it. Roger built a loft. So we had the loft up top, which had a couch and a TV and you know, the bong and whatever else was up there, a record player. And we'd sit up there and jam. And we would harmonize. And we didn't even realize we were practicing. We were just playing.
Fucking around, yeah.
Messing around.
Yeah.
And then it kind of came to my attention one night. We had some friends over, and this one girl, a couple girls in particular, like, you guys are like professional singers or something like that. And the way she said it, it was like very innocent, but it wasn't what I knew what she meant by it. She's basically saying, you guys are really good. And kind of light bulb went off, and I'm like, yeah, we there's something here. You know, it was really rough around the edges still, but there was definitely something there.
How did your life change when you signed the big record deal? Hello Rockview in particular is obviously, I guess that's the one where, boom, you guys are on a rocket ship to Mars.
You know, life didn't really change. You know, we got signed to Capitol for a very small deal. It was a $100,000 six-album deal, and it went from there. The next album, we got $125,000. The next one, we get $150,000. The next one, blah, blah, blah. You know, unless you had a mega hit, and then you could probably negotiate to get a little bit more, which we didn't have. But, you know, we did Losing Streak, and it was funny. When we put it out, people were like, doesn't sound like Pezcore. I mean, Losing Streak is pretty rough if you listen to it. It's rough around the edges. It's amazing that a major label released an album that sounded like that in 95. And I don't mean that to discredit the record, but it's a punk sounding record.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we went and made Rockview. We were on the road forever. We wrote a bunch of songs on the road and had the record about half finished. Went in and we were just making another album. There was no really thought of what this could be or what that could be. And then it just kind of happened in the States. And then immediately following it happened here for us. When that record got released here, it went through the roof. And for us, it was what happened in the UK with our band that was kind of like, holy shit, what's going on? It wasn't really anywhere else. It took a minute.
What you mean in terms of like the big festival crowds you're in front of and just the numbers you're drawing?
Just getting recognized, you know.
Just on the street day to day.
Yeah, we got a push over here back then. You know, we were on magazine covers, billboards, you know, you're getting your faces plastered in the festivals on posters. Kerrang, Big Cheese was behind us. BBC was playing us. I mean, it was happening here. And we'd already been a band for 10 years, and it was cool to watch it unfold because we were able to appreciate it instead of being...
And not get swept away in that overnight success kind of thing.
Because we knew, you know, like, and it wasn't being self-defeatist or anything. Like, I was like, unless we have some huge hits and we take that next tier level and you're Green Day or whatever, we're in a pretty good world right here. This is crazy. Enjoy it, you know. Remember one time getting out at the Manchester... We played the uni, and there's like 300 kids surrounding the bus. This is 8 a.m. with all their records. And all I wanted to do was go have a shit. And I look out and I go, how am I going to get off this bus? I'm not.
Full Beatlemania style, isn't it?
It was crazy.
How exciting. And how old are you at that point as well?
That's the thing. So this wasn't 97, 98. This was, when this was happening over here, it was around 2001.
So was this the... Anthem album?
No, this would have been pre-Anthem. So this would have been Borders and Boundaries.
Right.
Yeah, this would have been Borders and Boundaries.
Right.
And it just was like the perfect explosion. Like I said, I'd walk into after parties and all my best friends or metalheads would be playing.
Like last night.
And, you know, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. And no, I mean, that was crazy because that never happened in the States. So what happened here was really neat. It was really cool. But in terms of the States, we were just out. And the only thing that really changed was more people were turning up to the gigs and we were selling more merchandise. But, you know, we never sold astronomical amount of records or had a huge impact in the States. But we were just out there doing our thing, doing the Warped Tours, doing the next really good tour with our favorite bands and friends, and just trying to strategically, you know, fly the flag for what we wanted to do, and the seeds that we sown back then are the reason why we're still doing it now.
Well, it's incredible to me that, I mean, how many years are we in now? 25, a little bit longer?
27, yeah.
27 years, you're still packing venues and people still come to these shows in their drones and still love it. And it's really the live side of things where I think your longevity and your, you know, core of the band really exists, isn't it? It's putting on these amazing live shows that people come out time after time after time.
Yeah, thanks.
And love.
That's really it. You know, it's and thank God for that, because you can't recreate a live show. I mean, yeah, you can sit in your living room and watch YouTube on your 55-inch flat screen, but it's not the same as being at the show. And
no, you got to have that smell, that energy.
And we have that. We have a fun show, and we have that going for us, and we've always been a live band. So even though back in the day maybe we didn't get to the next level record sales wise or all that, even if we would have sold an astronomical amount of records, there's no guarantee we'd even have this many people still coming to see us. Maybe we'd be like, oh, those are those has-beens that had a couple hits.
That's it.
It's weird,
sometimes,
right?
The success overshadows the longevity and the credibility. A band that's a great example of that is like a Wheatus. Right, they just had that one song that was, and they're a great fucking band. And I saw them play, and the guy, he's so creative and loose on stage. He basically just made up the set as the night unfolded. He'd just get people to scream out songs, and their fan base, like the few that were there, these hardcore fans that know everything, and nobody requested Teenage Dirtbag to the end, and then they finished with that. But it's like, that band is kind of seen as a one-hit wonder by, you know, most people in this country, at least.
Yeah,
and America
sometimes
as well.
It's an unfair tag. Yeah, you know, the band doesn't deserve it. Like they're a really damn good band, you know. So, but yeah, it's the old blessing and the curse. But for us, it's, you know, we just kind of what was the thing, the tortoise and the hare? We're just kind of
just riding it out,
kinda
man.
Kind of going along, man. You know.
I want to ask you about this. What's up, buddy? How are you?
Good. Which one?
I want to ask you about this. For me, and I'm not trash talking here because I've spoke to all these guys about it on the podcast that I've done with them. In the Orange County scene, there's a lot of politics and there's a lot of rifts and there's these dilemmas and dramas. Do you know what I mean? And
okay.
With Monique and Aaron and John, and there's all these fallouts. And you guys seem to me to be the only band in this kind of ska scene, if you want to call it that, that hasn't had fallouts with these other people. Do you think that just because you are separate from that Californian thing,
oh, yeah,
you perhaps weren't ingrained in hometown politics?
Yeah, this is for sure. We were never included in that bunch because we weren't part of that scene. You know, we weren't. We got labeled as that a lot. Aren't you from Southern California? Well, that's because all the other bands are from there to play ska and play punk. But no, we were from Florida, the opposite coast. Completely different vibe. You know, when we were doing shows, we weren't playing with 5-6 different ska bands in Florida in 1992. Like, we'd be sandwiched between the Pearl Jam tribute and, like, the Stone Temple Pilots wannabe band or whatever the flavor of the week was, you know. And it was a way different scene. So we never got swept up in that stuff really, really over there.
And is it nice then? Do you feel like you do exist kind of in your own little island? Or is that also a lonely place to be sometimes? Like, do you not have any peers that you see as such?
Well, no, it's both. I mean, there's times when, because we're not part of that, you know, little boys and girls club they have going out in California. And I don't say that disparagingly. It's just we're not from there. So there's been times when, wait a second, why aren't we invited to this festival? Or why are we playing second out of 10 bands when, like, you know, probably deserve a little better billing than that, and just part of the territory, man. And you just either you can let it bum you out and ruin your career, or just accept it for what it is and move on. So yeah, we feel it.
Well, the other interesting thing is, you know, obviously, you know, Vinny's recently left, and we'll talk about that in a bit if that's okay.
Sure.
But for the large part, it's been the same dudes since day one. And that's another thing that I think is unique to you guys. Real Big Fish is like kind of always a different band. Goldfinger, always a different band. Safe Ferris, always a different band. And those guys don't seem to be able to remain friends and in groups together. Whereas you guys, all these years later, you know, and obviously I imagine there's sometimes tensions and fallouts, as all bands have. But it's like, how do you guys keep it running as this kind of unit, as a family, as friends all these years later? What's the secret to that?
We split the money evenly.
Is that what it is? That's straight up what
it
is?
Absolutely. I've been saying that for years.
That's what all bands should do.
When one guy's living in Beverly Hills and the rest of them are living in Compton, you got a real problem.
Yeah.
You know, so. Yeah, I mean, because it's always money that messes up bands, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
So was that always the case from day one? You guys were like, this is Even Stevens, this is a democracy.
Yeah.
Good foresight on your part.
Yeah, we knew. That was I always say we only made one right decision our whole career, and it was that one, is to keep it fair.
Only one.
Yeah.
That's perhaps being hard on yourself.
Well, no, I mean,
what were the wrong ones?
Only one true. I mean, I think we made a lot of good decisions, but I don't know of them to be true. But
right.
The one I just said, I'm convinced that was the right decision, was to do what we did, because we're still around with the same band. You know, Vinny was with us for 26 years, and you know, he left last year, and you know, it was.
What was his reasons for leaving? If you don't mind getting into that.
No, it was exactly what he said. He wanted to be home, be a father, and raise his daughter. He has a now 8-year-old daughter, and he wanted to be there for his daughter. And he has a lot of other things going on.
He's still running the record label.
He's still running the record label. Yeah. He's still working behind the scenes for Less Than Jake, still doing all the merchandise and social media stuff. And so there's been no fallout there. It's just he didn't want to be on the road anymore.
And obviously he's always written the lyrics. Is that right?
That's correct.
Is that still the case, or has he stepped back from the songwriting now?
So we're forging ahead.
Because you're working on a record at the moment, right?
Yeah, we have not been working with him on the record, no. So we're all going to be writing lyrics, Roger, myself, the rest of the band. And not to take anything away from Vinny, he was the chief lyricist all those years, but you know, we all wrote lyrics and fit things in here and there to create the songs. So there will be a void there, but it's a, you know, this is a new time for the band, and we're embracing it, and we're excited, and we think the fans, if you like our band, you're still gonna like the stuff.
Well, in terms of not taking anything away from Vinny, does it feel like a new chapter? Obviously, you know, you've got Matt, who's been with you forever as well, so he's just, you know, the perfect fit. Do the live shows feel fresh? Do they feel different? Does the writing feel fresh? Does that feel different? Does it feel almost like a, as you say, a new chapter in the band?
Yeah, it does. You know, you can't, a band member is never replaceable, because like our fingerprints, each one of us is unique. You take that energy away, it's never going to be the same. You could say, oh, well, the new drummer is better, or the new drummer is this. And it's just, no, the new drummer is just a new drummer, or the new guitar player is a new guitar player. It's not really to do with ability. It's how you gel. And we, like you said, we've known Matt forever. He's started out selling our T-shirts 17, 18 years ago. And, you know, when we were looking for someone to, you know, take over the drum throne, he was like the perfect person, because we had known him all these years. We knew he was a great drummer, and why go out and get some kid to, you know, to come play drums for you and you don't like his personality after 2 weeks?
It was too perfect, wasn't it?
It was.
Oh wow, there's a guy right there.
So, you know, but yeah, it is different. It's a different energy. It's a different human. So there's that aspect of it. Matt brings a different energy. The live shows, we've been rejuvenated in a sense, because we've, you know, things got stale with us as we kind of like rested on our laurels. And when Matt came in, he's like, what if we play this song? What if we play that song? I was like, really? You want to play that one? Sure, we'll try it. It's maybe a track we hadn't played in 15 years. So he brought that kind of sense of fire and urgency back, which was great. And working with the new material, it's been the same way. You know, you have to pull from different resources, because you don't have someone providing, you know, providing lyrics. So you're pulling in a different way for your songs, and you're collaborating with each other in a different way because it's not there. So it's exciting for us. And hopefully, like I said, we like the songs. Hopefully the fans like them.
Well, you make a joke of it every night when you play new stuff, is you're like, you only want to hear the old stuff. And, you know, I think you're very aware of that. And I guess when you're a band, you have to keep creating. Otherwise, you're just, you know, you're a nostalgia tribute band to your own band, right?
And
so you
have
to keep putting out records.
We could go out and play nothing after Anthem. Play Hello Rockview, Borders and Boundaries, and Anthem. Those three records. Nothing before, nothing after. And we could do that for the rest of our career, for however many years that would be. But that's not the reason we got into a band, you know. So we still like to create and do songs. And
which new stuff have you been enjoying playing from, I say, the latter half of the Less Than Jake catalog? Because you've been mixing it up almost every night on this tour. And
yeah,
pulling things out and old B-sides. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the new song that was on our last EP called Things Change. It's just, I don't know, it's kind of got all the elements of Less Than Jake in it. You know, the ska part, the heavy part, and both of us singing. And so.
Well, that's the other thing with you guys, is it's not like you did this one record that was so drastically different. You know, there's been obviously deviations along the way, but it's never like you made that one album and they're going, oh, what have they done here? Like, do you know what I mean?
You know, it's like anything else.
You know
else.
The ingredients you, that you make know. You guys special and unique.
If you give them the same thing, it's the same as the last album. If you give them something different, it's different than the last album. So it's the old
damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, it's the old catch 22. What are you going to do? But we, again, at the end of the day, you have to, you know, write songs from your heart and from yourself, which I believe most people that commit to music, most people do that, you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What would you be doing if you weren't doing music? Right,
screwing
now.
You on an insurance policy. Now, if you get the two-part plan at $49.95 a month, we can...
With that hat on, hopefully, as well. Yeah. Like, a real hard hat.
Yeah. What? Turned up with a hard hat, but he was naked.
So is music kind of giving you your life? I mean, let's talk about the importance of music and punk rock and what that scene and that style of music and what this lifestyle has brought into your life and what it's giving you.
It gave me a place to go when I got to college. Because I just had this fire in me. I just wanted to play music. I wanted to eat, breathe, and sleep it. And Gainesville was like the perfect place when I went to uni there. It was great. There was a bar in every corner that had music every night of the week. And I immersed myself in it and didn't even realize that by skipping all those classes and going and spending money I didn't have on shows and what have you, that I was educating myself. I was learning. I was watching. Oh, that man's loading in. Oh, that's what that means. Oh, he's checking the microphone. Oh, that's how you do that. I was paying attention, without even realizing I was, you know. So by the time we got out, I mean, we were playing around Florida for three and a half years. By the time we got out on our first U.S. tour, we were about as prepared as you could get. You know, it was like it was on. Yeah, they were all firsts, but it wasn't. They were first in the sense of, okay, we've never been to Cincinnati, Ohio, but it's really no different than Daytona Beach, Florida. If you look at in terms of that, we're in a building and we're going to play music to people.
Yeah, that have come here to see the music that we do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about the Bon Jovi tour. Put me in the fucking storm that.
So,
and how did it come about first?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm going to say. So in the summer of 2000, we get this phone call. Our agent, CAA at the time, represented Bon Jovi. And they were putting this tour together and threw our name in the hat. But our name was thrown in the hat with like Sugar Ray, Eve Six, Smash Mouth, Dishwalla, all these like radio things or Marcy Playground that were happening at the time. And all those bands turned down the Bon Jovi tour that fall. Bon Jovi was kind of looked on as passe by 2000. They hadn't released a record in the States in like 5 years. And people didn't realize the importance of what were now soccer moms the value and the money that these people had, soccer moms and dads.
Well, it's why country's so huge.
And
it's
how,
that same sort of scene, isn't it?
You know, it seemed like it was so far removed. Oh, my God, it was 14 years ago that 1986 Bon Jovi was around. But think of if I think about 14 years back now, it's like anthem days. You know, it's weird how time changes as you get older. So it was still pretty fresh in people's minds of how big that band was. But anyways, all these bands denied the tour. They didn't want to do it. We get this tour. In between July of us saying, yes, we'll do this tour in November, July or August, VH1 in America, which was now the new MTV for people that were in their 30s then. Because people in their 30s weren't watching all the reality shows and the crappy rap videos or whatever they're playing on MTV.
MTV Cribs and all that.
All that crap, you know. So, and I like rap, by the way. I didn't mean rap is all crap. But just the terrible cheese that MTV was spewing out. So the 30-year-olds wanted somewhere to go. VH1 was giving you that. They were playing Bon Jovi videos. They picked up the Bon Jovi song, It's My Life. The song went through the roof at Radio in America. Okay. And
was that released around that time period?
It was released, yeah.
I didn't realize that. The production on it's so convincingly old school. It kind of sounds like it's from the earlier
period. So in those 3 months, the song and the album blew up. It was called Crush. And we had booked this tour, confirmed it. It was sold out 15,000 and 20,000 hockey and basketball arenas every night across the states. Well, across the East Coast. We did 3 weeks. And it was just us. We'd go on from 7:30 to 8 p.m., and then there'd be a half-hour changeover, and Bon Jovi would play from 8:30 to 10:30 every night.
And what were the shows like?
It was hilarious,
the crowd
man.
Reaction.
So we'd come out. The doors are only open for a half hour. So doors are open at 7. And we play at 7:30 to 8. And about, so doors would be open for an hour and a half when Bon Jovi would finally hit the stage, and everyone would be there by then. But when we go on, it'd be like guys with their ties half like off their neck and like be reading like the Wall Street Journal, like newspaper. And I'm not kidding you, in the front row, like be reading the paper while we're on. And so they didn't realize what kind of band they were getting. So you could imagine the guy in between songs, what we were saying to him, and it was just Mr. Scalby down beating people with like rubber hammers and stuff that we had these blow up hammers. He would like smack people, would run around, and then we'd just tearing the crowd apart every night. It'd be like, holy shit, man, Lita Ford's here, and it'd be some blonde woman, and we would just do in every cliche we would, but it worked, you know.
Like they received it well.
They received it well. And then like Tico Torres, the drummer from Bon Jovi, it was the second day of tour so we went from Fort Lauderdale day off, then Boston. So we had to fly. Our bus lagged behind us to make it to the next show. So we played. I don't know why that happened, but they started in Fort Lauderdale, then went immediately to Boston. We were in the Northeast the rest of the time. But we get to Boston. I'm walking the hallways, and I see him coming towards us. He goes, "Hey, you killed me the other night when you said, hey, we're less than, or no, not less, well, hey, we're Winger from Florida." He goes, "Winger, ha." I thought it was hilarious. You know, so he got the joke that we weren't making fun of them. We were making fun of the whole scene, you know, because John Bon Jovi especially, he didn't want to be attached to that whole thing at all. Because that was a lot of record label stuff where like, here, you know, you're the pretty boy, grow the hair long, you're the
give us a ballad,
us a ballad, the whole deal, you know.
And they treated you well? Like, did the production side of it?
I mean, kind of. We were put in a broom closet every day.
Okay.
I remember Heather Locklear, who was married to Richie Sambora at the time, she had her own dressing room. And we were in literally like a broom closet. Yeah. Of course, that's his wife. Were they going to give the band a dressing room and put her in a broom closet? No. We got two bottles of water a night.
For the whole band.
Excuse me. Two bottles of wine a night, a case of water, and towels backstage. No food, no
beer.
And
you're crushing these big arena shows, and then that's the reality of the catering side.
Yeah, that was it. Well, the catering was great. Like, the food backstage was great. And we got fed. We got fed like 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We got one kiosk in the arena to sell merchandise, which was usually up on like the third tier back by the fucking handicap shitter.
Did you sell much? Did you sell anything?
we
winning over any new fans?
$215 here, $400 there, $300 there. It was nothing that was life-changing. But we did the tour for the press.
Yeah, of course.
And they paid us pretty good. It was $5,000 a night they gave us, to be honest.
Nice.
Which in that time was really good money. Still good money.
You've obviously done a ton of tours. Is there one tour that stands out as just this legendary moment in the band's career, in your life, when all the elements were just exactly right?
Oh,
it was just, you know, fucking hellfire on wheels. Like
Us, Guttermouth, Descendants, 97.
Yeah, that's the one for you, is it?
That was the first one where it was like, this is over the top, man. It was like every night we could just, there were people turning up to see us. you know, yeah, they were there for Descendants, but they were turning, you know, we were realizing we were having a lot of fans, but we were also in front of people that had never maybe heard of us and definitely never seen us before. So when we came back, so we did Descendants in May of 97 and then went on the Warped Tour that summer. So in the fall, when we came back to the Warped Tour and the Descendants, the places we had played in those areas, our audience like doubled and tripled in most areas. It was like within 6 months. That's how that kind of touring works so well. We were playing in front of people that already liked this kind of music. It was the perfect storm.
And obviously Descendants would have been one of your childhood hero bands, right? So to be out there with them.
Absolutely. It was...
dreams coming true.
Yeah, it was unreal. And again, there was a mystique to them because they had been gone for 10 years. You know, yeah, they had splintered off and done all, but Milo hadn't been with them in almost 10 years, you know, 8 or 9 years.
So is this right after the Everything Sucks record, is it?
Yeah, right. That was released in 96, and then we did the tour in 97 with them. So they were still supporting that record.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that album, I kind of controversially think that's their best album, production-wise, song-wise.
Yeah, I would have to go there, too. That's my favorite record. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the 80s stuff have a charm and a thing about them, and I love those songs, but Everything Sucks is amazing.
My man.
Yeah.
Amazing. Chris, pleasure talking to you. I'm going to take you inside. I'm going to take you to another interview.
You were easy.
Yeah?
You were easy.
It's good to be easy. Do you enjoy it?
I loved it.
It's a good kind of a moment to have you finally on the show. It's a pleasure. I want to say thank you for bringing me out on tour all the time. And you're probably sick of the sight of me by this stage. But I'm grateful for the way you guys have treated me since day one.
And I'm grateful for you. And I want to do a station ID for you right now.
Go on.
Yep. Hey, this is Chris, Melissa, and Jake. And you were listening to Matt Stocks, DJ Matt Stocks podcast.
Can I come out tonight and kick some balloons?
As long as they're not mine. As long as they're not mine. And I swear it's the last time. And I swear it's my last try. And we'll walk in circles around this whole block. Walk on the cracks on the same old sidewalks. And we'll talk about leaving town. Yeah, we'll talk about leaving. I swear it's the last time. And I swear it's my last try. Cross that bridge all night. We talked our way through city lights. Traced all the lines. We're killing time under those buzzing signs. From downtown to anywhere but here.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.